Hi, my name is Ken, and I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here with all you sickies. I love coming to AA meetings because it's like being with terrorists, you know? It's like, I just love it. I want to thank Allison and Al and Barbara and Mary and Alex and all the folks who are involved in getting me here. And I've had a great weekend. I really enjoyed all the speakers. I mean, it's amazing the wealth of illness we have. But it's nice that we can keep it under control at conventions, you know? No one asked this last night. I mean, we did it broken down, but how many people in the room have less than, just raise your hand, have less than 1 year of sobriety, please? Oh, great. Great. Welcome. I don't know. I can't say I know how you feel, but I know how I felt it at a year, in that first year. You know, I didn't know if I wanted to be here or not. And it was kind of like John Bobbitt when he was asked if he wanted to get back with his wife, and he said, one part of me says yes, and one part of me says no, you know? And and that's the way I am, you know? Like, it's like, I don't know. I just didn't know. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time telling you how I used to drink because you can read the court records. But, you know, I not only drank stuff that hit the spot, I drank stuff that removed it. You know, it was like, early on, I guess, almost from the get-go, I was codependent because I was asking people questions all the time, like, is my fly open? You know? And somebody would say no, and I'd say, well, it should be. I'm peeing, you know? I was just that kind of a person. I had stuff go through my head sounded real good. You know, at one time I thought I could make a living selling hearing aids over the telephone. And it was like, it sounded okay, but when you go to do it, you know, my sponsor said, why didn't you come up with liver on a stick or something like that, you know? But the reality is that we have the kind of minds where we just process stuff differently. And I think, you know, that was the theme of this convention. It's that it's not what's going on. It's our perception of what's going on. You know, you constantly hear people say about the world is this, the world is that. The world is perfect. It's God's world. It's perfect. You know, we're still spinning on our axis. Gravity still works. All the laws of quantum physics are intact. Everything's in orbit. The world is perfect. And sometimes we just don't understand that. Because we have this capacity to just take in information, completely distort it, think about it, distort it some more, and then share it with people and distort it some more. You know? And then they repeat it and lie about it. You know? And then we wonder why there's confusion, you know? It's like the three guys who were in the mental institution and it was time for them to go home and they had to talk to the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist says, before you go, I'm going to ask you one question. And that is, how much is 3 times 3? So the first alcoholic said, 118. I think you're going to have to stay here just a tad longer. Said to the second one, how much is 3 times 3? He said, Tuesday, defiantly. He said to the third alcoholic, how much is 3 times 3? And the guy said, 9. He said, oh, thank God. He said, how'd you get that? He said, it was easy. I just subtracted Tuesday from 118. You know? And that's the way we process this stuff, you know? You know, out in our area, there's a lot going on now with the big trial, you know? And it catches on to everybody. People who can't even spell DNA are suddenly experts in it, you know? Like, well, what do you think? They're going to admit the DNA? Yeah. I got sober with guys that thought Moby Dick was a venereal disease. I mean, they just didn't know. And so when you come to our group, we don't have any of these real heavy hitters. You say, how long are you sober? We go, you know, like, that's about it, you know. It's like we have no idea what's going on. But one of the things we know about is getting into action, and that was another theme of this weekend's talk. I mean, Tom mentioned it, both Keith mentioned it, Clancy mentioned it, Nancy mentioned it. It's about getting into action. And it doesn't make any difference if you don't understand why you're doing it. The main thing is to get going and do it. In our area, we have T-shirts that says, be a verb. You know, we have too many nouns. AA is divided into two groups, those who do the work and those that take the credit. And we have found out that to get into the first group is a lot easier. There's a lot less competition. You know, go and do something. You know, don't sit around thinking about it. That's why, you know, in the big book, which I call the owner's manual, you know, there's a chapter, working with others. It doesn't say thinking about others, caring for others, empathizing with others, therapy with others. It says working with others. And you know, anytime someone comes up and says, do you really think we're different? And I said, well, let's just read the literature. We have great literature. And it says in there, it says, you know, the delusion has to be smashed that we are like other people. It doesn't say denial. The denial has to be smashed. You know, that word came into AA about 10 years ago. Nothing wrong with it, but it's too wimpy a word for alcoholics. Because if you look up the word denial, it says, someone who knows the truth and doesn't want to admit to it. You look up the word delusion, it says psychotic thought. Where this person has no idea of the truth, you know. They don't have a hint, you know. I mean, denial is like spiritual growth, you know. It's like, you know, hey, I was delusional a couple of months ago, now I'm in denial. Hey, you know, you're heading right towards rigorous honesty, you know. And it's just a perceptional thing. You know, alcoholics are like a flea on a log coming down a river. And every now and again, the log goes around a bend in the river, and the flea thinks he's steering. You know? And if he's an alcoholic flea, he buys a commander's cap and a whistle. You know? Because he thinks he's in charge of something. You know, and he's in charge of absolutely nothing. And that's why the old-timers always laugh at the newcomers, because they know they got to go through what they went through. Like, yeah, you sure do know a lot. Yeah, I wish I was as clever as you. You seem to have answers for everything. Here's a quarter. Go get a coffee, you know. It's just amazing. And it's that way traditionally. I mean, you just look at us. You look at us and you say, you read the material and you say things like, Miles was reading from chapter 3 today, you know, more about alcoholism, and you read that chapter, and it says, you know, we're like jaywalkers. We get hit, we get knocked down, we get up, we lose a leg, we break an arm, we just keep going. We don't care. We're having fun. And then you get to chapter 4, and it says, the alcoholic is faced with terrible alternatives, either to live on a spiritual basis, or continue on with alcoholism. Well, let's go back to chapter 3. Spiritual, you live nice, you're happy, you're joyous, you're free, you get up in the morning, you really appreciate life. Well, that's a tough choice. And the other chance is, you know, you're miserable. And as Clancy described last night, you die, your brain swells up, you bleed from every orifice, you don't know what's going on, you have a diaper. Wow, these are tough decisions we got to make now. Do I want to do this or do I want to do this, you know? But the reason it's a tough decision is because we don't have that decision. See, it's not a choice for an alcoholic. If you be an alcoholic, a real alcoholic, you have lost the choice. And so what you need is a power greater than yourself. You know, I do this in a visual with newcomers because the newcomers I work with. Fortunately, most of them are named Bob, so their name front or back is spelled the same. You know, so when they make a belt, all they got to do is get the O right. But they just, you know, they just don't know what's going on. And the bottom line is that's the whole deal here. No one knows what's going on. And the only reason the old timers look so smug is they've already figured out they don't know. So when you ask them the technical questions, they'll say things like, read the book. Go to meeting. Talk to me. And it's amazing how you can get caught up in stuff, you know, stuff that sounds good, but it just doesn't mean anything. It isn't worth a hoot. You know, there was a guy, he coached in the NFL, and now he's a sports commentator for the National Football League, John Madden. And John Madden said that when he was coaching the Raiders, at the end of every halftime, he doesn't know where he heard it, he doesn't know where he read it, doesn't know where it came from, But right before the Raiders went back out on the field, he would say, "All right, this half, let's forget the mule and just load the wagon." And the guys would go crazy, and they'd go out and they win. He said guys would retire and call him on the phone, you know, and say, "Coach, yeah, what does that mean? You know what? What does that 'let's forget the mule and load the wagon' mean? It doesn't mean anything." "Yeah, I know. I don't know what it means either, you know." Guys were going to the Hall of Fame, didn't know what it meant. And in AA, we have the same thing. Sometimes people just press you so hard, you have to come up with a little defense mechanism rather than tell them you don't know. The only time an alcoholic says he doesn't know is when he's being indicted. You know, I don't know. "Could have been me. Was driving my car, you know." But that's the only time. So, you know, you gotta get developed something that kind of keeps people at a distance and buys you some time. So I came up with this thing, and I just say to people now, the fish in the sea are not thirsty. So what you're saying, Ken, is the fish in the sea just ain't thirsty. Thanks for sharing that. Then about a week later, you see a group of newcomers, and you hear a loud voice say, "Well, the fish in the sea are not thirsty." Now you see eight guys going, "In the sea, in the sea." And then at night, you get calls saying, "Ken, is it the same for the fish in the ocean and the bay?" And the, yeah, you know, like, those are the guys who have degrees, you know. I mean, it's like watching somebody milk a mouse. You know? A lot of activity, but very little results, you know? And that's what we do. We scratch shit that don't itch. You know, like we're thinking about stuff that no one else is thinking about. You know, I mean, sometimes you come out of a meeting and you just heard the same speaker that everybody else heard. And you wonder where they were.
You know, well, I heard him talk about...
No, didn't you? He talked about the big book. He talked about recovery.
Yeah, but he said something, too, about my mother.
I mean, we have this selective hearing, all these words going by, you know? And you know, I got sober in New York, and you know, it's like when I went to California, it was a very different thing for me because, first of all, you know, the ocean's on the wrong side. So when you get out there, you realize, hey, the beach has been misplaced. You know, like, and it's like people just look at things differently. That's why it was nice being here last night. I listened to the tide coming in and the tide going out. And, you know, all of my life, when the tide started to go out, I started to chase after it. I didn't realize that that's a natural phenomenon, that the tide comes in. Sometimes things are coming my way, and they just keep coming my way, and it looks like I'm on a roll. And then other times things are going away from me, and I think I'm losing something. And what I don't understand is I just stand there and keep doing the same things, it comes back in again. It's just a natural deal. I didn't know it was a natural deal. So when I start to see it go, I, you know, like, let's mount up and get after it, you know? And I was always on the move. You know, I love kids today because I hear kids say, "My mom says I'm not thinking enough in school." My mom never wanted me to think. I mean, my mom would walk through the living room, and if I was sitting there, like, thinking, she'd knock my feet off the end table. "Don't you do that!" Because she knew I had the capacity, you know, to come up with a bad idea. And then I had the courage to implement it. And then she had to work on acceptance, you know? And it was like, you know, my mom used to say, every time you think, you place some part of the world in jeopardy. And she was right, because my mom raised seven kids, you know, and I was listening to Keith and Clancy and all talk about the relationship, this male thing with their dad. My dad died in my arms. When I was a kid, my dad died of alcoholism, and his feet were squirting on the floor, and I held him, and in 4 or 5 minutes, he was dead. And his eyes were terrified, and he was kicking all over, and I looked, and I thought, how could you do this? Do all these kids, and you're doing this to us. And little did I know that within a period of time, what he was doing to his family, I would go and do pretty much the same thing to another family. I just didn't, and you know, I just couldn't grasp the fact that you could. I thought my dad had choices. I thought, you know, like, geez, why didn't he just stop doing this? Now, this is ugly. Now, he didn't beat us or anything because my mom would kick the shit out of him. But But it was a deal where it was a simple deal where he just drank all the time, and then he was dead by 50, and there was my mom with all these kids, 7 kids. I was the youngest, you know, and it was like, and we all grew up so healthy. Somebody said, you know, Ken, your family was the healthiest family. Like, you know, you never had your appendix out, you never had your tonsils out. I said, yeah, my mom had 4 words that covered everything, and that is, we have no hospitalization. You know, so. So when you felt bad, she'd just say, go lay down. When you feel better, get up, you know? Like, and to this day, when I feel bad, I just go take a nap, you know? Well, something coming on, you know? And fortunately, I had good sponsorship. Keith alluded to that the other night. I had good sponsorship, too. In fact, I came to a meeting, and the guy who told me at my first meeting that he'd be my temporary sponsor is still my temporary sponsor today, you know? And that was over 24 years ago. Now, I don't know if it's going to work, but he seems to need the drill, you know, like, and the bottom line is that I didn't know how when I first arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I see this so clearly today, but I couldn't see it when I got here. I did not have living skills. I had survival skills. I knew how to survive, but I didn't know how to live. And it sounds crazy, but I always felt I could take care of myself. No matter what was going on, I always, as long as there weren't other people involved. I mean, take away the people I loved, and I could survive. Of course, I could pretty much put up with anything and get through it. I just felt that. Now, I'm not saying that was the truth. That's just the way I looked at it. And when I got here, it was an amazing thing because I had a guy sponsor me who basically became like, not a father figure, but he was a father figure in a way. He had kids, and I watched him with his kids, and he interrelated with them, and it was healthy. And it was healthy because he was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was healthy because he was practicing the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you take alcohol away from the alcoholic, you're left with the ick. You know, now what are you going to do with this ick? You know, you got to deal with it. You know, it's like, now the alcohol is gone. The thing that used to be the solution is gone. And I used to love New York people because they had a very simple way of putting things. When I was young, people used to say, you've got to focus on doing this. And everybody was always evaluating me. It seemed like every time I turned around, somebody was testing me for something. You know, and they say, go get it. Your son's got to go and test in this area. I lived in the same area in Brooklyn all of my life, and it changed names every year depending on who was in political office. We went from being poor kids to ghetto kids to inner city kids to deprived kids to underprivileged kids. We were the same kids. You know, like, we were the same kids from generation to generation. But they keep coming up with new names. And I said, God, you know, I just got another name I got to live with here. And I was always being tested. And what it was I just didn't know what was going on. And nobody knew that I didn't know. They kind of knew from my actions that I wasn't fitting in, but they had no idea what was going on. And I didn't know. And I was so good at mastering what I was feeling that you never knew what I was feeling. I mean, I had this great capacity to be crying on the inside and laughing on the outside. And people just would look at you and say, well, you know, he seems to be getting better, you know. And I learned at a young age that there are certain things you don't have to communicate. You throw around into a pump shotgun, you don't even have to say this is a stick-up. You cut down on all the vocabulary. You know, you go in with a handgun and try to hold up a place, you got to do a lot of talking and screaming. I got a gun! You go in and go, hey, got you one. Like, what do you need? Yeah, take this, you know. You know? And so I used to find things before people officially lost them. And it was like, and that's not a good career choice. You know, and the reality is that I just didn't know. But I didn't know I didn't know. And I remember one night a guy in New York pushed me in a corner and he said, be what you is and not what you ain't. Because if you is what you ain't what you is. I thought, that's it. I never had anybody put it so clear. You know, be what you is and not what you ain't. Because if you is what you ain't what you is. I spent my whole life being what I wasn't. And now somebody was telling me to be who I was. And then it was a process through the steps to uncover, discover, and discard, to find out who this guy really is. And it was an amazing process because it's still in progress. It will always be in progress because the perception I have of what's going on today, although it's greatly improved in my vernacular over what it was before, it still needs a lot of improving. It's constantly spiritual growth. It's constantly, you know, there are great lines in the book that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Now, if God has all the power, that means there's none left for me. All I have is the ability to take action. But the results are in God's hands. And the nice part about that is the fact that all spiritual programs, whether it's Alcoholics Anonymous, church groups, or if it's a true spiritual program, it has four basic components. That is, you show up, you pay attention, you tell the truth, and you leave the outcome to God. And that's what we do here. I mean, we show up, we pay attention to the best of our abilities, we try to tell the truth to the best of our abilities, and then we leave the outcome to God. And it's like people say, do you know what's going on? I never knew what was going on, but I used to make it up. Because that way I thought, you know, it looked like I knew what was going on. But I never did. And now today I don't care. All I know is that I take a series of actions. And those actions lead to results. And those results are not in my power. I don't know how something's going to turn out. What I thought was good was bad. I mean, I hear people share this, and believe me, everything I hear, I've probably either said or thought myself, but I hear people get here and say, and I did too, I say, when I came to AA, I lost everything. And then I would give you a whole litany of all the things that I lost. And I was left with nothing. Well, it's 24 plus years later, and I can tell you this, folks, the everything I lost turned out to be nothing. And the nothing I was left with has turned out to be everything. And I just didn't know that starting out. And people used to say to me things like, well, change yourself, you know, do this and do that. And my family, you know, I don't know about the hereditary part of the disease, but my family would divide into two groups. Either you're in AA or you need it, you know. There seems to be no middle ground. My mom used to say the only time one of you kids would say no to a drink is if you misunderstood the question. You know, like, in fact, when I told her I got sober and my sobriety date was the 5th, she said, good, you did everything on a 5th. You know, like, so it was good that you got sober. And she used to say to me in the middle of my first and second year of sobriety, she'd say, drunk or sober, you are no day at the beach. You know, and because I had, you know, I was still doing all that crazy thinking stuff. And then I would implement that stuff. But today I have a little visual I can do with newcomers to show them what I never knew when I first got here. And that is, I ask somebody who I'm working with, what is your strongest hand? And almost everybody thinks they have a strongest hand. They'll tell you, my right hand, my left hand. And I say, okay, put them together and push as hard as you can. And what happens is you find out is neither hand is stronger than the other. And the reason neither hand is stronger than the other one being pushed together is because all the power comes from one place. Our ability to change is being counteracted by an ability not to change. That's just as strong. So the reality that I had to learn in AA is take the pressure off, keep my hands in the same position, and pray for a power greater than myself so I could feel that presence. And the reality is that I began to do simple things that led to very complex, without me knowing it, solutions. I like the book because it has a whole chapter. There is a solution. We don't take you to a point and say, we don't know what happens. You know? We do at the end of the book. I mean, I love AA because it writes chapter after chapter, and it's very knowledgeable and very informative. And then they get you to the last chapter, 160, you know, you're reading page 164, it says, but we know only a little. Why didn't you tell me that on page 2, you know? And the doctor's opinion, you know, he talks about the phenomena of craving and the obsession. But one of the things that most people don't read is further on, in the doctor's opinion, Silkworth talks about synthetic knowledge. Synthetic knowledge. He says there's a great deal of good that lies outside as medical people and professional people. There's a great deal of good that lies outside our synthetic knowledge. All knowledge is synthetic. It's, I learn from reading a book. That's not what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learn and share based on my experience. It's an experience, strength, and hope. It's not a knowledge deal. In fact, the text is very clear on that. In Bill's story, it says, surely this must be the answer, self-knowledge. And the very next line starts out, but it is not. You know, we don't want you to think that if you learn a lot here, you know, you're going to be a clever little duck. You know, you're going to be a drunk duck, you know. And so you say, my God, there's so much going on that I don't know. And all of the speakers this weekend spoke to me on the one topic, although they didn't focus it and name it, and that is love. Love and tolerance is our code. When people come in here, what they experience without being aware of it is love. And love is a language that the blind can read and the deaf can hear. It's a very special language. And sometimes it's just a matter of putting your arms around someone and saying it's going to be okay without doing or saying anything else, because now they feel connected. Most people, and it was mentioned at length again all over the whole weekend, most people get here feeling very different, and they don't feel part of. And yet, we are part of. We all swim in the same water here, and our job is not to pollute the water. There's a guy, at one time I was 4 years in a state institution, and it was a big error, and they caught me. But I read these spiritual books, and there was a book by this guy, John of the Cross, and the guy said to me, read this. And John of the Cross, he's a spiritualist guy, but he had some great lines, and he had some, probably the single most powerful line I ever heard in my life, and that is, he said, where there is no love, you put love, and then you'll find love. Where there is no love, you put love, and then you'll find love. And see, I was so busy looking at what to get out of something, I didn't know that I had the capacity to put love in there. And if I put love in there, I'll find love. And love has nothing to do with the other person. It took me a lot of years to figure that out. It took me a lot of years to figure that out. You know, a rose is perfect love. And the reason a rose is perfect love is because when you walk by a rose, it gives off its scent to everyone. It doesn't say, here comes Joe, I'm not happy about him, I'll close up. You know, it doesn't work that way. The rose just gives its scent off no matter who's walking by. And that's what love is, perfect love. Now, that's what we strive for. We're not perfectionists here, but that's what we strive for. We strive for spiritual progress. And spiritual growth and awareness, and aware of the fact that that's all we have to give is love. It's the most powerful force in the world. And when you inject it into a situation, it immediately changes the situation. When you come at someone from a position of love, you come at them from a position of neutrality. You know, love is a 10th step in action where it says love and tolerance is our code. And we have been placed in a position of neutrality. It means we're not trying to force our agenda on anybody else. It's like, here's what we do. You know, I have guys who ask me to sponsor them, and they say, like, what do I do? And I say, you got to come with me. I don't tell them anything, but you come with me. And they say, what do you mean? And I say, well, if you want what I have, this is what I do. And you come and watch me do it and be part of it. I go to meetings. I go to a meeting every day. I have a home group, Drunks Only. They see me there, tough group. And I sponsor people, and I set up chairs, and I make coffee. Now, everybody in AA basically does that, who stays around for a while. So it's not like that thing. But instead of telling a guy to do that, he comes with me, and we do it together, so that he knows this is what you do. It's not a theoretical thing like, well, you should make coffee, you should do this, you should, no. You come and be part of this. And if you want what I have, then these are the things I do. If you don't want that, that's your call. It's always your call. And it tells you, we have, you know, people say, well, I don't know how to be a sponsor. Well, then you're not reading the literature. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a chapter called Working with Others. And that whole chapter is designated to one thing, and that is to tell you how to be a sponsor. And there's nevers in there that are very critical. And I'm not making this stuff up. You have to read the literature. But one of those nevers is you never criticize another alcoholic. Never. I don't know what part of that word causes trouble, whether it's the ne or the ver, but it's never. Never. No exceptions to the rule. To be of help is our only aim. The other one is we never force ourselves on another alcoholic. Never. And then the third one is we never speak down to an alcoholic as though we're on some spiritual or moral hilltop. What makes this thing work is it's one bozo sharing with another bozo their experience about the literature and the experiences of life. And it's not about all this theoretical stuff. You know, it's not sex without partners, and you know, all, you know, it's like we're focused. This is what we do here. You know, we're focused in one area. You know, oh, you guys haven't heard of those yet, huh? Some of their meetings get out of hand, I'm told. But the reality is that we're dealing with very simple answers to complex questions, and they're so simple that it's easy to walk by this stuff. You know, it's like let go and let God. You know, turn it over. Take these steps. Admit that you're powerless. Smash the delusion. And sometimes, you know, it reads so easy that we want to add something to it. And, you know, but, and, you know, we want to add on to it. And the bottom line is that there's nothing to add on to it. The literature is very well written. I'm surprised that most people have trouble with the program after you hear a while. And I say that only from the standpoint that it's very definitive about what you're supposed to do. It has steps, and it tells you if you're having trouble with this, you do this. And I can always tell when someone's going to go out and drink long before they do. You know what they start to do? They start working the steps backwards. First, they stop going to meetings. They stop being of service. Then they cut down on prayer and meditation. Then they don't have to inventory. Then they look for people to start making amends to them. And then they work their way back to step two, where their insanity is restored. And once your insanity is restored, it's real easy to go pick up a drink because you're crazy again. And you just watch it. And you talk to folks and say, why are you not coming to meetings? I'm not getting anything out of it. Why don't you try something new? Why don't you try putting something into it? You know? And I just enjoy the hell out of it. I mean, I sit there sometimes and I'm laughing, and people think I'm laughing because I know something. But I'm laughing because I don't know. And I think of all the time I wasted trying to find out. You know? And it's like there's absolutely no need to know. And even in sobriety, when you're going along and things are good, there can be a loss of innocence. A loss of innocence to me is when something happens and you say, geez, I can't imagine this happening to me at this point at this time. But it happens anyway. And I had one of those loss of innocence about a year ago. My son, who was out doing everything he wanted in the world, he was traveling around the world on a cruise ship, and he was getting to visit all the world, and he was singing and being paid for it, and it's something he always wanted to do. And I got a call from Norway that he was very, very sick, and they were sending him home. And he arrived home July 8th of 93, and he was in full-blown AIDS. And he had gone from 190 pounds down to about 150 pounds. And he stayed with me July and August, well, from July to August to September, less than 60 days, and then he died. And I had a chance to be there for him in the sense that here was a kid that when his mom and I separated and divorced, he stayed with me, and I got to raise my kids. It was a very special time. So I was a dad who understood what it was to be with these kids. And here he was at home, and he was losing his eyesight, and he lost his hearing, and he was in pain all the time. And the only thing I could do is crawl in bed and lay next to him and hold him in my arms. And there's something about holding somebody in your arms that you love, that you can't do anything about, that leads you very clearly to the understanding of being powerless. I would have done anything humanly possible to change or alter his pain in that situation, and I couldn't do it. And to admit to being powerless is a tough thing for an alcoholic, because we always think, particularly when you hear a while, that, well, you know, I have these prayers, and I know this, and I'll just work on this. And there's nothing to work on. You know, being powerless is like being chosen most attractive in your cell block. You know, it's a... You're glad the guys like you, but you don't want to pick up the award, you know? It's like this is the way it is. And I had a chance to just be there for him. And I know God has a great sense of humor, because my ex-wife started coming to my house, and I got to meet my husband-in-law. And we would sit and have coffee and talk, gosh, it was thrilling. And my son ran a fever, was running fevers all the time, and he ran a fever this one night, and we were there packing with ice and doing all the things you do, rubbing them with alcohol, trying to bring it down. And he looked up, and there was his mom and my other son, his brother, and myself at the edge of the bed, and he said, "Wow," he said, "this fever is really powerful." He says, I'm having a delusion of a nuclear family, you know? And he ended up, in 1983, I had gone to work in the hospice program, volunteering to work with people who were terminally ill. Now, what led me to that at that time, I don't know. I just was intuitive thought. And so I did that from 83 to 93, and then in 93, the last few days of his life, my son ended up in that hospice. And I got to hold my son in my arms as he died. And I had held my dad in my arms as he died. And I have lost a sister and a brother to this thing a week apart. I had a sister die Christmas Day of 85 with cirrhosis of the liver. And she hemorrhaged for 2 months and died bleeding, weighing 60-some pounds. And a week later, my brother died, New Year's Day. So I understand what it means to live one day at a time and to have this moment and this moment only. During an 18-month period, I went to the cemetery 11 times. And buried people who I very much loved and cared for, but I was powerless to do anything about their drinking. Anything. And all the headstones are exactly alike. It has your name, when you were born, a dash, and when you die. And that dash is life. And on most headstones, it's not more than 8 inches. 6 or 8 inches. That's it. The dash of life. And it's what you're going to pack into that 6 or 8 inches. What you're going to pack into that life. And fortunately, AA has not only given me more life, it's given me more life to enjoy my life. I get up in the morning now, and I'm very thankful to be alive and very thankful to be sober, and I have no idea what's going to happen that day. But I know it's going to be good, because it's going to be fun. And it's going to be fun because I'm going to have one perception of what's going on, and something else is going on entirely. And then 3 or 4 months later, I'm going to figure out what happened that day, but I'm already into screwing up another day. You know? And I don't know anything, you know. And guys say, "That's why I like you as my sponsor, Ken, because you never say you know anything." And, you know, it cuts down a lot of technical questions. When you tell people you're unscarred by education and you don't know anything, you know, they don't come with real theoretical kind of stuff, you know. And you get to live life permanently in the now. And you say, geez, you know, the word now is so terrific because if you take it, it's spelled N-O-W. And if you reverse it and spell it backwards, it's W-O-N, one. When you learn to live in the now, you've won. That's all we have is a series of nows. We don't have anything else. And it took me a long time to come to that understanding. I just didn't know that. I had no clue that that was going on. And, you know, there's so much self-help stuff going on today. And I'm not in opposition to it because I'm in a state of neutrality. I stopped fighting everyone and everything. I just wish it wasn't there. In fact, if I had a wish and could wave a wand, I'd take all that stuff off the market. There's really only one book we needed, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the original big book. There's an original big book. Every religion has their original big book. But I think we should collectively write a book about our daily experiences, and it should be called I'm an Ass, You're an Ass. You see? That takes all the pressure off. Because when someone says, "Why did you do that?" "Hey, I'm an ass." You know, and instead of building to something, you know, you take the steam out of it, you know. And I love to come to these things because I love to see people laugh. And I know something about laughter that most people don't know, and that is you cannot laugh and think at the same time. So when you are laughing, you are not thinking. You know, you're getting a respite from your favorite topic, which is you. If there were a song in AA, it would be, "I am always on my mind. I am all in my mind." You know? It's just the way it is, you know? And the reality of it is that's why this program works, because we do not have a chapter in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous titled Into Thinking. Those are the three last words you want to hear from an alcoholic. "I've been thinking," you know? It would scare the average guy, you know, like, because we have those trick minds, you know. We go to a wedding, we want to be the bride. We go to a funeral, we want to be the corpse. and we want to do it humbly. You know, I don't want to be noticed. And the bottom line is that that's how we live our life. And I do it. See, that's why I identify. So when guys call me and they're in the middle of heavy stuff and it's crazy, that's why I'm a good sponsor. Because I've done that, you know? I had a guy the other night. He said, Ted, you were right 2 weeks ago. I said, how? He said, you told me you never had trouble giving something up right after you did it. And I said, that's right. He said, well, I just gave something up. He said, because I did it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And you know, do you ever find yourself driving home from a place saying, I'll never have to do that again? Because now I'm healed. I had the healing, you know. I didn't know I had alcoholism. I thought I had a communication problem with myself. I thought I would talk and I wouldn't listen. You know, because I would say, I'm not going to get a drink today. I am not going to get a drink today. I am not going to get a drink today. And then sometime during the day, I'd say, okay, I'm going to get a drink, but I'm only going to get one. And I wouldn't listen to me. I'd be on my way home, and I'd be having that conversation with myself, and then I would disregard everything I was saying and pull in and get a drink. And you notice that in all the literature, there's reams and reams of literature now written about alcoholism. I mean, you go into bookstores, and it's like, we've taken up almost all the bookstores. You know, there's a little room for microcomputers, but that's about it. Everything else is alcohol and the alcohol family and the recovery and this and that. And I love the big book because we take all of that crap, properly labeled, and we condense it down into a little tiny sentence in the big book. And it says, when the alcoholic drinks, something happens. I mean, is that definitive or what? When the alcoholic drinks, something happens. You can bet the ranch on that, you know? Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you. When this alcoholic drank, something always happened. I had no idea what it was going to be. I didn't know where it was going to start. I didn't know the middle. I didn't know the end. But I knew something was going to happen. I just didn't know anything else. I thought alcoholics were sometimes very, very hard on Al-Anon until I spoke a couple of weeks ago at the Texas State Al-Anon Convention. Those Al-Anons have some terrible, terrible jokes. They told a joke about the Al-Anon who was out golfing and she hit the ball into the rough. And when she went in to retrieve the ball, there was a lamp there and she rubbed it. And out came a genie. And the genie says, you can have 3 wishes, but they come on a condition. And the condition is, whatever you wish for yourself gets tenfold. So she happened to be separated from her alcoholic husband at the time, which is a very, very uncommon event. And she said, I would like $1 million because I could use the cash right now. And Jeannie said, no problem, but remember, your husband gets 10 times that. No problem. What's your second wish? She says, well, I'm living in a little one bedroom with the kids. I could use a big house. Jeannie says, no problem, as long as you realize your husband gets 10 times that. No problem. And then finally, Jeannie said, what would you like for your third wish? And she said, I'd like to have a little tiny heart attack. Do you know all the Al-Anons left? I didn't think it was very funny. It's like rigorous honesty. You know, the alcoholic who comes home and says to his wife, honey, I have a question to ask you. She said, go ahead. We're both working on rigorous honesty. He said, do you ever fantasize about other men when we're having sex? She said, hell no, there's never enough time. You know, so, you know, it can get cruel out there. Or the guy who just took a 90-day token and he says to his wife, you know, honey, I'm my own worst enemy. She said, not while I'm alive. You know, But that's why it's important to laugh at the, you know, it's life should be laughed at, because it's too serious to be taken serious. You know, there's too much that goes on. You can get so caught up in life that you lose track of life. You know, you become so detailed oriented. I sponsor a guy who's a psychiatrist, God love him. He doesn't stand much of a chance right now. But I mean, he is constantly milking a mouse, you know what I mean? I see him at meetings across the room. He starts to do this, Sally. I don't know how you stay sane and be a psychiatrist. I mean, it's a chore, because you just have so much stuff going on all the time, and then you go pick up stuff, you know. You're accumulating other people's stuff, and everything needs a label. And it's just funny to watch him, because it's like watching him twist himself into a knot. And he's thinking all the time. I almost feel like my mom, like, knocking his feet off the end table, you know. I walk by and kick him. Like, don't do that, you know, like you're hurting yourself. But that's what he has to do until he doesn't have to do it anymore. But it's the reality of, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we share our experience, strength, and hope. And you find out perceptionally that you're wrong about most things. And that doesn't mean you can't live a good life. It just means that you can go and enjoy whatever's going on, as long as you're willing to just take it as it is. You know, when my son was going through his deal, he was in pain, and he used to want to use the bathroom, and he was in so much pain, he had lost so much weight, that he couldn't use a bedpan. And so he would crawl on the floor. And, I mean, as a parent, to see a 29-year-old, your 29-year-old son that you raised, crawl on the floor just to get to the bathroom, and then be so exhausted that on the way back he'd fall asleep on the floor. And I would put pillows down and blankets because he had neuropathy and he was just so in pain. And it came to me very clearly one night when I was watching this and my heart was breaking, that I crawled on the floor and I lost my dignity. And here was my son crawling on the floor to maintain his dignity. So the action of crawling on the floor is neither good nor bad. It's just crawling on the floor. It's what brought you to that. You know, the actions of the alcoholic, we were brought to that. We were brought through that through our own series of things we did and things we failed to do. And the clarification of sobriety is coming to the realization, just as it says, is that, you know, the delusion has to be smashed. The first step of recovery here is recognizing that I'm an alcoholic. It's a very important awareness. You know, we have several people here who have less than 30 days, because I got to meet a couple of them. And, you know, in that first 30 days, there's a lot of stuff, you don't know what's going on. All I can tell you is, you will know what to do once you start taking actions. You get the answers to life by living life, not thinking about it, but by living it. We used to have an old-timer in our group, and he'd say, even if you fall on your face, you're moving forward, you know? And that's the whole idea, to step out and start to move forward, start to take actions. And I didn't know what those things were. I always thought that you could manage well. You know, I just needed to manage better. And I didn't know how to live life. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is it's taken all the parameters and all the barriers and it's set them aside. And it said to me very simply, and I saw this very clearly last year when I was going through this thing with my son, either God is everything or God is nothing. Either he is or he isn't. Either you're going to live your life one way or the other. There is no middle ground. And that's just the way it is. You know, John of the Cross, this guy that I love so much, said, to get to the place you've never been, you're going to have to go a way you've never gone. And going this new way is very, very threatening sometimes, because I think it was Keith the other night who said, you're not used to doing it. I'm not used to living sober. I'm not used to taking pain and living with it. And there is some pain that is so tremendous, it's so at depth, that it takes you and twists you and changes you so that you can never be the same again. Never. Now, that doesn't mean you're better than anyone else. It just means you see the world through different glasses. Some pain is so intense it almost takes your breath away. I sat on the couch one night and I thought, I'm not going to get to breathe. It seemed like my breathing just stopped. And it had to do with the fact that I was in pain so much and so powerless. And so I just opened the big book and I started reading the little slogans at the end of the chapter. Let go, let God. First things first. Because they were quick and they were easy. And I didn't have to really concentrate on them. And I was very fortunate because in Alcoholics Anonymous, I developed a very large family. And people came and spent time with me and cooked for me. And guys who don't clean for themselves came and cleaned and washed and did things. And I had guys in and out of my house all the time. I have a lot of gadgets in my house. Anybody who calls me can attest to that. I have things that laugh and go whistles. I have a duck that goes, wow, you know. And it's like, when somebody says, she's leaving, I go, wow, you know. I lost my job, wow, you know. And as you come into my house, I have a big snow scene with a snowman in it. When guys come, I always ask them to pick that up and shake it while we're talking and then put it back on the table. And then while we're talking, of course, what happens is everything settles down once they let go of it. So now I have guys who don't even bother to knock. They just walk into my place, and I come out of the bathroom, and I find that thing's been shook, and they're gone. You know, it's like, who needs you anymore? We got the gadget, you know? Like, been replaced by a snowman paperweight. But there's the deal. I always flip to them and I say, hold that for a while. I don't want to hold it anymore. Put it down. Look what happened. You know, I leave stuff alone and just take action, and life seems to go real good for me. You know, I got up last Friday night. I guess it was a time change, and I looked out over the ocean, and I had left Friday morning. And I was on the Pacific Ocean. And I went to bed, because I'm from San Diego, hopefully where you'll all come to the International. We're expecting about 125,000 of our closest friends. And I was going to bed on the Atlantic Ocean. And I looked out. And you know, in the darkness of the night, when everything is still, I got up at 3 in the morning. Not by design, just got up. And I stayed up till about 5 o'clock, and it was so dark, and everything is so quiet, that you get a whole different glimpse of what the world is all about. And there's something about the darkness that you develop night eyes, where you can see in the dark. You develop eyes that you can make out forms, and it's almost like it's light, because you can maneuver in the room. And I looked out over the ocean, and it came to me very clearly that I could see things way off in the distance, but in the daytime I wouldn't be able to see because the sun being so bright would obstruct where they were. But at night they had a special vision. And you know, going through life, there are times when we go through what is called the dark night of the soul. And you just look into the abyss and you don't see anything looking back. And it's at that point that you develop what I call a spiritual awakening. And that spiritual awakening is God is everything, or he's nothing. It's just that simple. And then you have to be still and let God be God. And it's not about me doing anything. You know, God sometimes utilizes me just to show me how much I don't know. I think this is what's going on, and that's what's going on. You know, it's bang shots. He goes, he really thinks he knows. I'm sure he's, you know. I have just come to love God in a whole different way being sober. Not the way I was brought up. I thought, you know, any God that could give man a sexual peak at 20 and woman hers at 40 has got to be a comical God, you know, like, wait till they have to work with this, you know. And the reality is that everything is backwards, and that's the paradox of recovery. Everything is backwards. And that's why there's so much trouble for the newcomer. And I have empathy for the newcomers. Because when you come in, it's a language here. It's the language of the heart. If we could draw a diagram of recovery, it would be an hourglass. And as the mind empties, the heart fills. And you get to operate totally from the heart. And you don't talk about what you're thinking about. It's about, I love this. And God is great. And God will do the deal. if I just stay out of his way. And that's why it's a language so very different. I mean, try to explain to someone realistically, if you want to win here, what do? You surrender. Oh, yeah, makes sense. And how do I keep it? Oh, it's simple. You give it away. Oh, yeah, I think I'm really glad I came now. And if you stay here long enough and do the steps, someday you'll get to make amends to people you really despise. Geez, if I'd only found you guys sooner, I mean, life would have been just, a whole deal of bliss. And that's what it is. It's the language of the heart. The longest journey in my life has been about 6 or 8 inches. It's out of my mind and into my heart. And I go back to, when I was a kid, I heard the phrase being in the world but not being of the world. And I intellectually knew what that meant. And on September the 5th, 2 days before my son died, I understood what it meant by seeing it. I experienced it. Because he came off all his medication, and as a result of coming off all the medication, he came out of the coma he was in. And he was perfectly alert for 45 minutes, at which time he wanted to know, "Dad, what is happening and where am I?" And it was at that point he had to be told, "There's nothing they can do for you. You're in the hospice. They're going to keep you as comfortable as they can. This is the deal." And he rolled his head to one side of the pillow, and a couple of tears came out of his eyes, and he immediately shot his head back. The whole thing didn't take 45 seconds. And when he rolled his head over, he was in the world, and when he came back, he was of the world. Because all he talked about was how happy he was that his mom and his brother and I were there for him and that we stayed with him. And he just looked up and winked and said, "I'm okay with this. This is an okay deal, Dad." And there was nothing else to be said. And he asked if there was anything he should do, and just said, "Whenever you're ready to let go, let go. Just the stuff you tell newcomers, whenever you're ready to let go of it, let go of it." And then the other thing was, is that if possible, I don't know how this thing works, when we get to wherever you go, wherever you are, if you could come and meet us, that would be terrific. And he said, "I can do both of those. I can let go, and if possible, I'll come see you." And then he just talked to his mom and his brother for a few minutes, and I reached down and I held him, and that was it. And there's an awareness in there that you don't get by going to the movie. You don't get by avoiding that. There's an awareness there that comes that will be with me like my sobriety date to the day I die. It's just a cutting off point. And the reality is that I could have missed the whole thing. If I were drinking, we wouldn't even be together. But wouldn't it be like I had a shot to raise these kids? And I think of the time I took off from work. I took time off and I coached teams and I went to their games and I thought, my God, thank God I did that, because now I have that done. There's nothing like I missed out on. I was there. And we did those things. And his mom now calls me and stuff because she's going through some stuff relating to this. And, I get a chance to be there for a woman that I loved when I was a kid. I married. We were married 22 years. We're divorced 12 years now, I guess. But there's a love there that will always be there. It doesn't start. It doesn't have a middle. It just goes on. And that's what life is. That's why it's so very important that we take real good care of one another and not criticize, not make fun of, but encourage. And hold and love, because nature has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Only man has the audacity to make plastic flowers. Nature doesn't think of that. And so you have to really make hay, as they say, when it's time. And nobody today owes me anything. I'm not volunteering, but if somehow I were to check out today, if my ticket got punched today, nobody owes me anything. I've had a hell of a ride in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had 24 plus years of life. It's a life I wouldn't have had otherwise. And I got it to come to Bozo meetings, hanging out with Bozo people who didn't know any more than me and didn't tell me that until 20 years later. Well, now we don't know either. But we sure fooled you, you know? And I get to laugh a lot at things because there's a lot of funny things going on, you know? Out in L.A. now, there's big signs on the back of the trucks, bring back Tonya Harding. I mean, you know, like, people, I just love people because they're always looking for a laugh, you know? You know, God is a comedian playing to an audience that's afraid to laugh, you know, because we And I want to thank you for inviting me here. I want to thank you for letting me be part of this. You know, I grew up not having the worst of anything. My mom loved me, and there was never any doubt that my mom loved me. And she loved all the kids. And I've had a chance now to be sober. And I've had a chance to not only travel around and do this kind of stuff, but if I never got a chance to do this again, I am the most important thing you can be in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is I am a sober, active member of a group. And I go to meetings, and people expect to see me there. And they call me, and we do things together. And life is real simple. Tom told a story the other night about how things change. You know, they come and they go real fast. There's a great Buddha story that I love to tell. And Buddha used to travel around the country preaching and talking to people. And they would stand in line and they'd come up and he'd interface with them one-on-one. And one day this guy came up and he slapped Buddha's face. And Buddha said, "Is that all you have to say?" And the guy was probably alcoholic. He went home, he inventoried, did whatever he did. The next day he was back in line and he worked his way up again. And when he got in front of Buddha, he said, "I owe you an amends." And Buddha said, "Why?" He said, "Because I am the man who slapped your face yesterday." And Buddha gave the perfect AA answer. He said, "You do not owe me any amends, because the man whose face you slapped no longer exists. And it's quite obvious that the man who slapped his face no longer exists." And that's just how quick it happens. We are changing moment to moment. And the whole idea is to remember that no matter what anybody tells you, everybody has a right to be here. Everybody has a right to be loved and cared for. We're all God's kids. It's just that simple. And don't scratch stuff that don't itch. You know, I mean, I watch people doing things sometimes, it's about as useless as hubcaps on a tractor. You know, you just say, it just doesn't make sense. But it's a lot of activity. And the reason they have activity is because nobody likes to be still. Alcoholics do not like to be still. Being still for an alcoholic is a death-defying act. You know, it's like, let's go do something. What? I don't know, but let's, you know, let's get a jump on it. You know, there's a great Irish poem called by Apollinaire, and it's called "Come Down to the Edge." And I'm going to tell you this thing, get out of here. And that is, "And the master said to the people, 'Come down to the edge.' And the people said, 'No, we're afraid.' And the master said to the people, 'Come down to the edge.' And they said, 'No, it's too high. We may fall.' And the master said, 'Come down to the edge.' And they came. And he pushed them off. And they flew. And they realized fear is just a word. It's not a reality. And that God is the only reality." And that's the theme of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know, and you don't know. We may kid each other that we know at times. We have glimpses of reality. Most of us don't take up permanent residence. You know, nice to wander in, but nice to wander out, you know? So if you're here and you're giving this thing a look-see, hold on. Hold on. Stick with the winners. Success leaves clues. That's why we say stick with the winners. The winners are doing the actions. And don't listen to yourself when you hear yourself say, "I can't do this. This won't work for me. It's okay for them, but I'm different." You know, all the things you heard this weekend. We have a mind that tells us we're not sick when we are. We have a mind that tells us we're less than when we're equal. You know, I once heard Malcolm X talk when he was in New York, and he said something that will stay with me till the day I die. And he said, it's not about what people call you. It's about what you answer to. And that's a very, very important in our lives. It's not what people call us. It's what we answer to. And hopefully, as a result of the steps and all the things we do here, you'll be able to answer to sober alcoholic. God bless you. I love you. Have a good day.